Viola Rapp, grave 607, cemetery 2, buried 1934. I was admitted to the asylum in 1929 as patient number 7074 from Ross County.
From WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. This is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. Viola Rapp was a young mother in the late 1920s when she was admitted to the old Athens Lunatic Asylum, a place now known to many in the local community as the Ridges. When she died there, her body was not claimed by her family, and Viola was buried under a numbered tombstone on the asylum grounds, along with about 1,900 other people. There are three cemeteries on the asylum grounds that contain mostly tombstones with just numbers, no names or dates. Thanks to the research done by Doug McCabe, a retired library archivist, Viola's life story is now known, and her family was able to put a named marker on her grave. We now know, thanks to Doug's work, that Viola likely suffered from postpartum depression. Doug, you're joining us now. Thank you so much for being here and sharing these stories. Even though we don't know for sure what mental illness Viola suffered from, you and her family believe it was postpartum depression. Tell us why you think that.
Yes, and putting that together was just not finding really any medical records that indicated that, but by surmising that Viola was placed in the asylum shortly after the birth of her last child.
Well, once I heard her story about postpartum depression, I felt very connected to it, as you know, Doug, as well, because I had suffered from postpartum depression with both of my children. And when I heard that, you know, that was likely the reason she was institutionalized, it really kind of shook me to my core and wanted me to and compelled me to try to tell her story on a larger level. So I guess we're continuing to do that today. We did it in a documentary several years ago, but we're also continuing to do that now. And to add on to the tragedy of Viola's story, she died at the asylum in 1934 after contracting tuberculosis. Was that a common thing to happen back then?
Well, tuberculosis is a communicable disease, not unlike, say, the Spanish flu or other diseases. And when you have people living in close proximity with each other, you're going to run the risk of spreading communicable diseases relatively easily. Now, there was a tubercular ward, and then later on a tubercular building, actually two different tubercular buildings. One was just a simple wood frame building, and then it was torn down and a more substantial building built where people identified with tuberculosis could be isolated from the rest of the staff and patients.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Doug. And now we're going to hear from Viola herself to tell us her story through a first-person style account. Roughly 10 years ago, Doug and I worked on a documentary for WOUB Television about those who were buried under the numbered tombstones at the asylum. It was called The 1900 Voices from the Athens Asylum, and Viola was the reason that I was initially attracted to produce that program, as her struggle with postpartum depression was something that I was so familiar with. I needed to learn why she ended up in the asylum, buried under a numbered tombstone with no name, and her story is one that started with childhood tragedy, and the continuation of that tragedy into adulthood eventually led to her time at the asylum. Here's Viola telling her own story with the help of her granddaughter, Nancy Morris, and voice actress, Jan Hodson.
She was born in 1908, and she was the second child of Lulu and William Cottrell.
I was one of eight children, and I experienced some tragic losses, including losing my best friend, who was also my sister.
Her older sister, her name was Rosa. Rosa died when she was like 13 years old. So my grandmother Viola would have only been around 11.
A few years after Rosa died, I got married. But it wasn't to a man I chose. It was to a man my father chose for me.
At 16, she was married to my grandfather, who was like 11 years older. She had a baby at 7 months, a gestational age that only lived about 10 hours. Because he, you know, was premature, unable to, you know, take enough nutrition or unable to make it. And then about a year later, she had another son, Russell, actually Luther Russell, but we called him Russell. And he was born with some health problems. It's within 6 months of that, and in December of 1929, that she was admitted to the hospital.
Daughter Dorothy was very young, 4 and a half when I was taken to the asylum.
Now joining us is Jackie Wolf. She's a professor of the history of medicine at Ohio University and specializes in the history of women's health and children's health, along with the history of public health and the history of biomedical ethics. She's also the host of WOUB's Lifespan podcast. Welcome, Jackie.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Viola had two devastating childbirth experiences before she was brought to the asylum in 1929, and her family believes that she was suffering from what we now call postpartum depression. Tell us what you know about how women in Viola's situation were treated at that time.
Well, you have to understand, we need to know more about her class. Women were treated, this was an era in U.S. history when everything was defined by your class and your situation. So upper class women would be treated one way, middle class another, rural women another. So the context was always really important. It could very well be, you know, we don't know what, we know one of her children was born prematurely and died shortly after birth. We could not say premature children in that era because we had no conception of what was wrong with their lungs. We were not able to treat their breathing problems. She apparently was admitted within 6 months of another pregnancy. You know, but in that era, when women were, you know, what we use now to define depression, what we use now to define any kind of mental illness, in that era, if women were mentally ill, it was really defined by their reproductive organs. Because the thought was, men certainly got depressed. But the thought was that when men got depressed, it was connected to their brain. When women got depressed, it was connected to whatever this meant to them, their nervous system. Mm. And the thought was that the uterus was directly connected to the nervous system. So often treatment for women's depression for whatever reason, or mental illness in women for whatever reason, treatment would often be, depending on their class, removal of the uterus.
Oh, wow.
Or possibly cauterizing or tying off the fallopian tubes. The association was very direct between reproduction and mental illness in women.
Wow. Wow. So obviously doctors didn't understand postpartum depression as a thing to treat at that time.
Well, they had a name. What the name for it then was puerperal insanity, meaning after giving birth, you just went crazy. Hmm. So they did have a name for it. It was a different name than what we used. But as you can tell from that, you know, just the stigma of insanity and just the extreme of using the word insanity, there was an implication there that implied a lot. And you have to understand, women then too, they could be committed just on the word of any male relative, whether it was a husband or a son or a brother. Women had very few rights when it came to being committed.
Wow. So was there a piece of the Appalachian culture that might have been involved here, too? Because someone told me that it kind of speaking to what you said about the women not having a lot of rights at this time. If they had what was termed a defective child, that also could have been a reason for her to be admitted to the asylum. Is that something that you know anything about?
And it's not. You know, I have focused so much on the history of urban women and urban health. But I can tell you, I mean, all I can tell you is what I know about that era having to do with urban areas. I have to say, if a child was born with whatever defective, whatever terminology, especially that was used then, the children were usually either institutionalized, and the families were advised. The focus was really on the child,
okay.
Much less so than the mother. Appalachian culture could be different, but the child generally was either institutionalized, and the family was advised, forget you ever had this child. Or what could happen quite often is the child was just put aside, not given any nutrition. Often the mother would just be told the child had been stillborn.
Oh, wow.
And the mother would never know she had given birth to a child who was living and had some kind of disability.
And then I guess finally, you know, after hearing Viola's story and all the research that you've done, as a woman, you know, what runs through your mind? What kind of feelings do you have hearing about what used to happen to women back in the day and the asylum and all across the country?
You know, it's a feeling of absolute powerlessness, complete lack of control, feeling of real humiliation, I think, that... certainly that mental illness was that stigmatized and that something could happen to you like that, being put in an institution that you had no say over, no ability to prove possibly that either you weren't sick or this was temporary or what was happening to you was perfectly logical in terms of you get depressed after a baby dies. How is that not normal? It would be abnormal not to be depressed. So it really, it's just a feeling of such helplessness and hopelessness. I can't even fathom how devastating that would be. And given a situation like that, it could only make your mental health worse, I would think.
Thank you so much, Jackie, for being here and just sharing your insight on medicine and what happened to women during this time.
And, you know, it's my honor to give them a voice again.
Thank you so much. Now, even though Viola's situation was tragic, we know the tragedy didn't end with Viola's hospitalization. It continued on in the lives of her living children. Here's the rest of Viola's story, told by Viola through voice actress Jan Hodson, Viola's granddaughter Nancy Morris, and Viola's daughter, Dorothy Schrader.
I was a little girl, and my mother was ending sick, or whatever you want to call it. But she was put here in the hospital. And I did not get to come to see her. I mean, I got to at first, and then she got sick. And so it made it rough. But she's always been in my mind, my heart, and my soul.
I was depressed. Some think I was brought to the asylum to deal with what people today refer to as postpartum depression.
Nowadays, you know, we know how to help people when they have things like that. There's medication, there's therapy, we have support groups. And back then they didn't have the support system that people can get now. They didn't have those things.
With her and other people, they need to be known. Because it's not their fault. It's just that health-wise or whatever happened in their lives made it that way.
While I was in the hospital, my husband lost custody of the children, and Dorothy ended up in an orphanage in Pickaway County. I died when I contracted tuberculosis at the asylum in 1934, and Dorothy wasn't permitted to come to my burial.
I knew that my mother was dead, because they did tell me. Some official, because I didn't know who it was, wanted to come pick me up and take me to see my mother, so before she was gone, you know, before they put her in the ground. And so that was something that really, at that time when you were told, no, you can't go to see your mother. You can't. So from that time on, I just more or less blocked everything out.
Decades later, when questions popped up about what happened to me, Dorothy and her own children did some research. They tracked me down and found my grave.
I'm glad she's in a resting place where she is, where we, her family, or any other family can come and see.
Memorial Day 2010, a ceremony is being held to honor me and others buried in the asylum cemeteries. For Dorothy, who is now in her late 80s, it's the funeral for me she never got to experience. Even though it's difficult for her to get to my grave, this ceremony is closure for her, and it's emotional.
It's beautiful. Mom, this is the best day of your life and mine.
Joining us now to talk more about Viola is her granddaughter, Nancy Morris. Nancy's mother, Viola's daughter, Dorothy Schrader, passed away in 2020. Nancy, tell us what putting a named stone on her mother's grave and having that ceremony that we had at the Athens Asylum in the graveyard there in 2010. How did that impact her life?
You know, it brought her closure, and that was the main thing. When her mother passed away, she had been in the Pickwick County Children's Home for about 4 years before her mom passed away, and it was a really rough time. And when her mom passed away, they came to see if the children's home would let her and her brother Earl, who was also there, go to the funeral, or, you know, whatever they did back then. I don't think it would have been much, but if they could go, and she wasn't allowed to. So she never got that closure. And I think over time, the pain of losing your mother, not really knowing for sure if your mother died, or, you know what I mean? It was just so painful that she kind of shut it out. And it really brought her closure. So how it came about that we started finding details is when I had my youngest child. I never had a grandma on either side. Both of my parents lost their mothers when they were 8 years old. It's ironic, but it was a painful thing for both of them. And we never had pictures of either of them. But we were able to find my father's mother's grave easily, you know, because that was local and we could find that. But my mother wasn't sure where her mom was. And I think she had blocked it out over time because it was so painful. So I just kept asking and asking about it. And then we were invited to a 50th wedding anniversary of one of her aunts down in Columbus, Ohio. And we went there, and that was the first time we ever saw a picture of her mother. And we were able to talk to family and, you know, learned a little bits and pieces here and there. And, you know, I just kept digging and digging and finding bits of information. And so we finally found out where she was buried, and we went out to the cemetery. We had contacted the, he was the pastor for the Ridges Asylum, and he took us out to the grave that was number 607. And so we thought that was her grave, and years later, obviously, we found out that it was the wrong one, that we went to the guy's grave. But my mother had purchased a stone. She wanted to have a stone for her mother. She didn't want her to just be a number. And so we went out there and we placed a stone ourselves at the cemetery. And years later, though, we found out when we went to go put flowers on there. It was my son, my mom, and I. And we couldn't find the stone. So we were like going up and down the aisles looking for the stone. It's like, you know, what could have happened? And then we found the stone had been moved, and it was at another 607. But then in 2010, when she was recognized by the state and they put a wreath on her grave and we had the service at the cemetery, it was like my mom, it was like a child that was releasing all of the pain and all the sadness. And it just brought her so much calm and peace after that. Just wonderful closure for my mom. She cherishes that. She cherished that, the DVD of the service. And it was just wonderful for her to have that closure after all those years.
That's unbelievable to hear, you know, because where Doug and I left off with your mom was that ceremony. And so I never really knew how it impacted her. Doug, how does hearing that affect you?
This is the kind of thing that I think needs to be made available to so many people. Nancy, as you had noted earlier, no one knew in your family where she was, and how would you? That's the other challenge, is that now people do have a way of finding out who's buried at the asylum, but at that time you didn't, and so these folks would just drop off, and how do you find them? And so that was part of, you know, my motivation for trying to get into getting that information out.
What struck me when we were talking earlier, Nancy, before we started recording for the podcast, we were talking about your career, and you were a nurse in the I think I'm saying this correctly, like the neonatal intensive care unit, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, now knowing that your grandmother's story was so related to tragedy, that you now know how to prevent, right? You now know how to save the babies that caused her such grief. I find it amazing that you didn't know that going when you decided that that's what you wanted to do with your career. Right. I mean, do you think about that? And if so, what are your thoughts?
You know, after that, I've always been focused on the moms, you know, since then, to make sure that the moms weren't getting depressed, because it's a very real problem when they get the postpartum depression and if it goes into psychosis. So we really try really hard to, you know, make sure everything is going okay. And some moms, you know, they're not so easy to get to, but we have like tools that we, you know, have them fill out questions about depression, but we also just use our own assessment skills. And if we see a mom that seems to be struggling, or maybe a mom that is like unsure about holding her baby, doesn't want to bond, we really try to get these parents to bond really good with their babies. And, you know, it's just, and that's part of it. You know, they need to feel that connection with their baby too, you know. And, you know, loss, neonatal loss is huge. Nobody should ever have to bury their child, or you know, it's such a horrible time, but we try our best to make it as easy as we can on families, because it is an overwhelming time for them. And you know, anytime you lose a baby, we would all feel it. It would be all of us. We would, it would be draining for us, but we would stay strong for that family, because that family needed us.
Yeah, and you understand that greatly now, knowing knowing the history of what happened to your grandmother. For the people who are listening to the podcast, they could only hear, you know, hear the ceremony, but we were all there in person and saw it. And your mother, you know, almost lost her footing. Like, I actually thought she was going to pass out at one point because she was so overcome. Yeah. What do you think about that second ceremony, you know, touched her so deeply?
I really felt that she felt like her mother was finally getting a funeral, and that she was there, for the funeral. And so all of those emotions that she held so deeply in her heart, in her mind for her mother, all of that pain, it kind of like ran out of her, and she kind of got weak, you know, and just kind of like, and I like you, I thought she was going to like, you know, pass, you know, like just
pass
drop
out
to her knees, you know, I just, because it was just, but she really needed that. And I'm just so sad that her brothers, Earl and Russell didn't get a chance to be there. They had passed before then. Yeah. But because that would have been great if their whole family could have felt that, you know, and been there for that.
So how old was Dorothy when her mother Viola passed away?
She was 8, and she had been in the children's home since she was 4. She was 4 years old. She was the oldest. She was born in 1925, and then her brother Earl came next. And that was 1926. And then in 1928, this is the other thing about me working in the NICU. Her third child was a boy, and we didn't find out till after this ceremony that he was actually born at 7 months premature and lived 11 hours, but died because he couldn't eat. He died from not being able to, he was not able to take anything to sustain life. So that's why he passed away. So that had to be horrible grief for my grandma.
Yeah.
And then the last one, Russell, he was born with hydrocephalus, which is the extra fluid in the brain to kind of make it in lay people's terms, you know. So, you know, he would have a fuller head, so he might look a little different, you know, when he's born. But now they have great things that they treat that stuff with. But as a new mother, I'm sure she felt like maybe some anguish and guilt after losing the one that, you know.
Right.
And then Russell having hydrocephalus, you know, it was like that had to be so traumatic.
Yeah, so overwhelming.
And so that's why it makes sense that a week after she had him, she just started a downward spiral.
I bet. Now, your mother, she passed away in 2020. How old was she when she passed away?
94.
Wow. That's amazing. You talked a lot about how that ceremony impacted her, but was there a visible difference in her? Was there a weight lifted?
Yes. I mean, I can honestly tell you that you could tell she was different. It was like, she was like at peace. You know what I mean? It was, you know, it was really hard being a child that was brought up in an orphanage. And there was a lot of problems with that, but she just had all of this peace after that. And I just really feel that she felt that she finally was at her mother's funeral, because that's what it felt like. You know, it was just a great way to honor her mother, and, you know, just to be a part of that, to actually have been there, it had to have touched everybody's heart to be a part of that.
You know, Doug, I'm sure that when you hear Nancy talk, you hear how this helped Dorothy. It makes you feel proud of the work that you've done.
Oh, most certainly. I've seen this with several other instances as well, and it's it's important closure for people. It's important to honor the lives of those who were patients and are buried there. Because after all, before everything else, they were humans.
Yes.
Yes, some trauma and tragedy came along in their lives, but that can happen to lots of other people too. But to treat them as humans, and then to understand that there are, in most cases, descendants who need to know and understand these experiences and appreciate them for what they were, and find closure for themselves as well.
Absolutely. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for telling us your mom's story. We really appreciate the time that you've taken with us today.
I just want to thank you guys for your work that you do at the Ridges Cemeteries. Bless you guys for everything. It's amazing. These people, they had lives, they had life stories, you know, and it's just great that people get to learn about them, and they have, it makes it more human. It's kind of like they're forgotten, and they shouldn't be.
I am no longer just Grave 607. My name is Viola Rapp.
And that is the story and impact of the person buried under Grave 607. Her name was Viola Rapp. On the next episode, we'll learn about the life and impact of Civil War veteran Adam Kern and the great lengths many went to make sure he and other veterans were properly honored for their service in the asylum cemeteries. Now we turn to you. We know Viola's name and her story, but there's so much more work to be done to give voice to those who were voiceless. We want to hear your stories about long-lost relatives and your families who you believe may be buried under a numbered tombstone at cemeteries across the country. We'd love to share your story and see if the work done in Athens might lead you to some answers and maybe even a name on their grave marker. Email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer. Artwork by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe and Jackie Wolf for contributing their knowledge and voices to this podcast, and Jan Hodson for her work as the voice of Viola Rapp. If you like the show, please rate and subscribe or visit woub.org to learn more.